Welcome to the Cloud Pod, where the forecast is always cloudy. We talk weekly about all things AWS, GCP, and Azure. We are your hosts,
Justin,
Jonathan,
Ryan,
and Peter.
Episode 154, recorded on February 23rd. The Cloud Pod is quick and rusty this week. Good evening, Ryan, Jonathan, and welcome back, Peter.
Hello.
Hey, everybody.
We're all here.
Good to be back. Yes.
I know, it's only the second time in the new year. We'll be back on normal schedule now, I think. At least I hope so. Until people go on vacation and run away from COVID.
Right.
Well, how was your week in the cloud so far? Has it been eventful?
It's been non-eventful, which is how I like it, actually. Finally been able to get some work done lately. Not patching or firefighting, which is great.
I mean, I got a bunch of work done because Slack was down for a few hours this morning. So
yeah, that's right.
I got a lot accomplished. I mean, I don't know if that was an Amazon outage or not, because I don't think Amazon ever updated their health status page. But there was a lot of complaining this morning that, you know, because I know on GCP didn't bother me whatsoever, other than Slack was down, which is perfect. So always good.
Yeah, I don't know of any Amazon related outages around that time, so it seemed purely isolated to Slack.
Yeah, it did seem pretty isolated to them. Although there was a couple other reports of, some news sites being down, a couple others. But
I mean, heard Peloton.
The internet's so fickle in some ways. Peloton, I think, was down. Yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, they're down for other reasons.
Right.
Yeah. Peloton's having a rough month, anyways. Yeah. All right. Well, I have a new segment for us that we're introducing tonight, and it's due to controversy. And so, with that said, let's jump into the Cloud Pod Court.
Order. Nice.
You're welcome. Ryan will be our judge and jury because his wife is a lawyer, which means he's qualified for all of our lawyering needs. And the argument is around a prediction made by Peter. Peter predicted at the new year that there will not be an all-in announcement from any of the cloud providers. And I have not one, but two pieces of evidence to say otherwise. And Peter disagreed. So I'll be playing prosecutor. And Peter will be defending his position. And I will summarize this quickly for you both. So Best Buy has selected AWS as a strategic cloud provider in this article. They say the collaboration will help Best Buy further apply cloud technology across its retail operations and support the rapid innovation of its customer experiences and the work of its teams to create world-class digital experiences that can enrich the lives of millions. Brian Tilzer, Chief Digital and Technology Officer at Best Buy Company, Inc., said, "Our purpose to enrich lives through technology has never been more important, and this new partnership with AWS is another step in our commitment to delivering outstanding experiences for our customers. Not only will AWS's cloud technologies help us in this work, but in combination with our culture of innovation and reinvention, they will give our teams invaluable development opportunities as we continue to grow our skilled teams and remain one of the best places for amazing technology talent to thrive." They then go on to explain to us how they used AWS to launch curbside delivery, which is what saved their bacon during COVID. And through the strategic collaboration, Best Buy will also accelerate the pace of its cloud migration and implementation of its cloud-first strategy, beginning with moving additional retail operation workloads from on-premise data centers to AWS. That's my first piece of evidence. Would you like to refute that, Peter?
I think that you made a good case that the relationship is strategic and is material, but not exclusive. And I think there's lots of evidence out there that Best Buy also has partnerships with Google Cloud. Five things to know about Google Cloud's Best Buy partnership.
Which was dated when, Peter? When was that dated?
Well, it was 2020. I mean, wasn't that long ago.
Yeah, but it was a multi-year deal. It was, you're talking about the big data analytics stuff. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was a multi-cloud deal. They still had data in Google Cloud, for sure.
Yes. In fact, the whole section in the article is titled "The AWS Alternative." So, yes. You know, I expect there to continue to be announcements around companies saying, we're going to go all in on the cloud, just not necessarily all in on a single provider. And even if they say they're going all in on a single provider, it doesn't mean it's true.
Well, I mean, in fairness, never has an all-in provider announcement been truthful, because they're always in that situation, right? They're typically on-prem already, or they already have, you know, other acquisitions they've done that are on other clouds. So, I mean, in the purpose of what an all-in announcement is, this is basically the new version of an all-in announcement as strategic cloud partner, which means that that's their first, the first cloud they're going to go to is AWS.
Does it
and then,
say
that little ML AI workload?
Does it actually say that they're only going to move to AWS?
It says through the strategic collaboration with AWS, Best Buy will also accelerate this pace of its cloud migration implementation of its cloud first strategy, beginning with moving additional retail operation workloads from on-prem to AWS. Moving forward, Best Buy will expand its use of AWS capabilities and AWS Marketplace, a digital catalog that with thousands of software listings from independent software vendors, it makes it easy to find, test, buy, and deploy software that runs on AWS to increase resilience, gain agility, and accelerate innovation. Now, that could all have been worded to cloud and be more generic, but does feel to me like they're expanding and going all in on AWS because Google failed them. Just me.
It feels to me like they, as part of their new EDP with AWS, they had a joint press release negotiated into the deal.
All right. That's my first piece of evidence that I agree. My second piece of evidence here is from Optimizely, who has partnered with Google Cloud to improve the digital experience. The digital experience platform provider Optimizely announced it had entered into a multi-year agreement with Google Cloud. As part of the agreement, Google Cloud and Optimizely will coordinate a joint go-to-market and sales execution strategy to develop digital-first marketing offerings to optimize the user experience for customers and to collaborate on technologies, including search optimization, AI, and ML. Now, the part that gets interesting about this particular one is that they particularly call out two competitors that this is going to help them go after, namely Adobe Experience Cloud, which runs on AWS or Azure, depending on where you're at. In that lifecycle, or the Salesforce Commerce Cloud, which is also an AWS all-in customer. So in this particular case, I don't think they're going to GCP because they want AWS in the mix as well. I think they want to be on GCP only because they think it's a differentiator. And I think this is an all-in announcement as well, Peter.
Does it say exclusive?
That's your defense?
That's my whole defense.
Does it say the word exclusive or sole, but it does not mention anything else. Just saying.
That's my whole argument, is that
I'm resting my case. I turn it over to Ryan for jury and just decision.
Ready to make my ruling. Yeah, this seems to me that Best Buy, their previous announcement was, we really want to use Cloud Spanner or BigQuery. And so I think that while the, like all these press releases, I think it was a little blown up then in 2020, as this one maybe. I there's a lot in here that I'm a little confused, you know, with the Best Buy announcement for AWS, as far as like, you know, they're going to partner for training their digital employee, which I think is a little interesting wording on what they're trying to do there. I mean, if you read through the article, it seems like that's more it's Best Buy saying they're going to hire at least 1,000 new employees of diverse backgrounds, which is great, but it is sort of strange. So you have to read through the tea leaves. I do think that the mention of AWS as the preferred cloud provider for cloud infrastructure is a pretty, it's not exclusive for sure, but it is basically saying we're going to go here unless we can't for some reason.
So they're all in on AWS apart from the things that they're not.
Exactly. Thank you, Jonathan.
Yes.
Thank you. Kate, I rest my case.
Jonathan, the reason why Jonathan wasn't chosen as the judge is he's too impartial.
He's too impartial.
I'm an elected official, Justin. I'm an elected official.
Yeah. Yeah, I do think this comes down to these big companies are going to partner to get and make these press announcements because they get that discount, because they do that. I don't think they will be any more truthful going forward. I think that's always the case in business. They're not signing any contract saying we won't use another cloud provider. It's just not in there because they wouldn't sign it. And they probably couldn't implement it if they did. So it really comes down to, is the spirit of the law about the announcement, whether or not it's about the announcement or the exclusivity of the announcement. And so.
Would you say that all announcements were ever exclusive?
No.
Exclusive. Okay. So is there a difference between an all announcement and this announcement, which also does not mention exclusivity? Mm-hmm. I would say not.
Well, I think there's a difference between an all-in announcement that we're going all-in on the cloud and an all-in announcement that says we're only going to use a single cloud provider. And that, my specific argument was that companies are not going to be making exclusive all in on a single provider strategies moving forward. Sure, there's going to be press releases about strategic relationships with vendors, but the concept of saying we see more value in, you know, in making sure we only use one platform, and what we're going to give up is, you know, these other services aren't going to be available to us, but what we're going to gain is that we're going to gain a deeper level of expertise with this one company. That's what, that is the strategy that I don't see, and I don't believe yet I've seen evidence that companies are continuing to do. I see the opposite happening.
I think for me is if we just re-signed, let's say, a three-year lease in a data center and then said we were going all in on cloud, is that a genuine statement because we still signed a three-year lease? Or is it the intention that we're going to migrate in the future?
Yeah, if that's your strategy. So that to me, if I had argued that companies wouldn't be making an all-in on the cloud argument and they had just signed a three-year lease in a data center and they said we're going all in on the cloud, then I would be wrong because their strategy is to go all in on the cloud. I don't see companies saying their strategy is to go all in with a single provider. I don't think the Optimizely announcement or the Best Buy announcement meets that threshold. And I'm standing by my guns, even though I don't have any
guns. Finger guns.
Standing by them. Yeah. Standing by the locker next to me that would be full of guns if I had guns.
I mean, I think that, you know, I can't remember a single announcement previously, which is no surprise because I can't remember any, much less one that was like saying we're signing an exclusive contract, or, you know, they're always worded with a little bit of wiggle room. And so preferred cloud provider, I think that term is very common. So I think this is no different from previous announcements in history. And so therefore the statement saying that, the proclamation of your prediction was that this was going to be a change this year from the previous years. And so my ruling is that you don't get the point.
Oh. I think there's a very different message in we're going all in on AWS, like Capital One did, for example. They specifically said, you know, here's our chips. We're going all in on AWS. Here's all our money. There's no chips left over for anybody else. There's a difference between saying all in, and there's a difference between and then saying preferred provider. I would say that the letter of Peter's prediction was no all in announcements, and we're only in February. He's probably still going to lose, but I think he should win this one.
Well, I mean, at this point, Ryan's made his jury, you know, his judgment on this. But you know, you can appeal this ruling later, and we can have another edition of the CloudPod Court, or other arguments you guys want to have with each other. Like this is a new segment for sure.
This is fantastic. Yeah.
Right. Honestly, the thing that blew me away about this was that Best Buy must see Amazon as a huge competitor in the market for all kinds of tech and software and computer gear and tech and everything for retail, just like Walmart does and Target. Yet they've still chosen AWS as their preferred provider.
Yeah. It just goes to show how well that platform stands on its own.
Yeah.
I mean, I think you have to ask the question of, like, am I actually hurting my business by not adopting the Amazon technologies that they're making available to me that they're using to kick my ass in retail? Like, why am I willing to settle for products that are not as good potentially? If I know that I can get the same things that Amazon's getting for their customers, if I just go buy it from Amazon. And yeah, I'm giving them some of my revenue, but, you know, is that really the revenue I care about, you know, versus losing hearts and minds of customers? And I think it's a hard conversation for many retailers to have in that space.
Yeah, and I think that the best argument I heard against using AWS for them would be that AWS is effectively funding the revenue is such high margin from AWS that allows them to be more competitive on the retail side with regards to money, you know, money losing ventures like free shipping until we figure it out. And so they would just not want to give their competitor that cash flow. But I mean, given the fact that it doesn't really matter if you're not going to buy it. I mean, they're so big now. I think that Best Buy's portion of that revenue would be small enough to where I, if it were me and our Best Buy, I would just be picking the best platform to run my company experience on.
Yeah. If you can use your biggest competitors' tools to compete with them in their own marketplace, then why not?
Yeah.
I would imagine that Best Buy's biggest expense is property. You know, Amazon don't need warehouses on the high streets in the middle of town. They have warehouses in the middle of nowhere on interstate exits. And so Best Buy will always have that problem if they want to have a presence for foot traffic.
Yep.
And I still shop there. I don't shop there very often, but I do try and shop there for things that I need in a rush, because I would hate to see the local stores get shut down completely and everything becomes online only. Same goes for books. Same goes for lots of things.
I mean, it's a great showroom for Amazon. I definitely like to go there and look at the stuff and then go buy it.
No, I'm just kidding.
I'm surprised they don't have like a captive portal device or something. You know, so you know, here, use our Best Buy free Wi-Fi kind of thing. And then when you go to Amazon, they say, you sort of overlay the page or something, or sort of insert things and say, hey, you know, but if you mention this at the cash register, we'll give you, you know, an extra 10% off or something.
I mean, if I didn't have such a strong aversion to retail Wi-Fi for that exact reason, they track you.
Yeah, exactly.
I might actually be able to test that for you. All right, Ryan, final verdict.
So I went back and I researched the original Capital One announcement. And the announcement states that Capital One has selected AWS as its predominant cloud infrastructure provider. So this is predominant, preferred. I think this is more status quo from what, 8 years ago now, 7 years ago. So I don't think anyone's really announcing an exclusivity contract. I think Amazon is using verbiage in some of their direct communication that says exclusivity all in. And those, like, I can find tweets in reference to that, but yeah, I don't think this is any different from all the previous announcements. So I stand by my ruling.
All right. Thank you, Ryan. We appreciate you on judge duty this week. Let's get on to the news this week. Peter, you can appeal at a later date with additional evidence.
Did you just call him Judge Duty? I think that's what I heard.
I love it.
Perfect. All right. AWS has announced the global expansion of local zones. Apparently they're jealous of that Oracle Garage data center strategy. I mean, it's such a winner for Oracle. And so AWS, of course, announced 16 local zones, all based in the U.S. in exciting places like Atlanta, Dallas, Houston, Kansas City, Las Vegas, Minneapolis, Philadelphia, and many other places. I won't list them all. But none of those are global. And so they have announced that those 16 are available to you now. And they're going to launch 32 new ones in 26 countries across the world. Exciting places in this list include Amsterdam, Auckland, New Zealand, Bangkok, Thailand, Berlin, Brisbane, Brussels, Buenos Aires, Delhi, Helsinki, Johannesburg, Lisbon, Manila, Munich, Perth, Rio de Janeiro, all kinds of great places. Oh, Toronto, Vancouver, and Warsaw, Poland, for all those things. The edge of the cloud is expanding and is now becoming available virtually everywhere, said Prasad Kalyanarama. Sorry about that. Vice President of Infrastructure Services at AWS. Sorry, Prasad. Thousands of AWS customers using US-based AWS local zones are able to optimize low latency applications designed specifically for their industries and the use cases of their customers. The success of our first local zones in 16 U.S. cities, we're expanding to more locations for our customers around the world who have asked for these same capabilities to push the edge of cloud services to new places. AWS local zones will now be available in over 30 new locations globally, providing customers with a powerful new capability of leveraging cloud services within a few milliseconds of hundreds of millions of end users around the world. And if you were like, what use case could that possibly be? I've got Supercell, the maker of all kinds of fun games like Clash of Clans that spam you in all your ads on mobile apps. They have to say here, our player base has scaled at an incredible pace, and we relied on AWS to manage our infrastructure and match our growth. We deploy game servers in multiple AWS regions today to serve our end users globally and evaluate all new regions as they come online. We're also using local zones as deployment targets in the U.S., and we are considering additional local zones as they become available in order to bring the latency-sensitive portions of game servers closer to more end users.
Yeah, I mean, this seems to be the loudest complaint, that I've heard recently from, you know, AWS customers, is the network latency to whatever region. And it's difficult, right? To create a AWS region, there's multiple data centers involved and all the redundancy at every layer. And so, I like this strategy. I think this is the a good move forward, because it sort of, I, this is the only path forward to get those network latencies as low as possible. And then, you know, I doubt it's going to be as resilient as a full region is.
So he's saying for AWS to stay in the business of providing services to these game companies that they literally have to pay to play.
Yeah.
Trying for the lightning round already. Too early.
Warming myself up.
Yeah.
You know, it does, to me, it makes a lot of sense just also from a standpoint of, I remember doing the first Direct Connect tests with Amazon around companies who couldn't move their large databases but wanted to expand their front end into the cloud. And, you know, that now if we can actually do Direct Connects to a local zone and be running compute there, could definitely be a factor.
Can you do Direct Connect to local zones?
Well, I'm looking at the list for Direct Connect locations, and one of them is in Kansas City, Missouri, but it's associated with US East Ohio. So I have to imagine that's the local zone in Kansas City.
Yeah, most likely. That's interesting. I didn't realize they would do that to local zones, because it seems like you can't really predict how many customers are going to want a local zone Direct Connect, and they're expensive to put in. So you would think that would be something they wouldn't do right away. I mean, I guess in low latency scenarios where you want it as close as possible, it makes sense.
No, it's usually just peering with a provider, right? Like it's not.
Well, it depends on the type you do. But yes, normally it's just peering. But you still have to cross connect and do things in data centers somewhere. So there's somewhere there's a cross connect that someone has to manage.
Yep.
All right. Well, AWS is getting quick and rusty this week with our new open source Quick protocol implementation in Rust. And if you don't know what that is, it's going to be the new bane of your existence when HTTP 3 is popularized. Quick is the foundation, of course, for HTTP 3 and is designed to improve upon TCP by providing improved first byte latency and handling of multiple streams and solving issues such as head of line blocking, mobility, and data loss detection. Quick was ratified less than a year ago by the IETF, and AWS is introducing support for Quick protocol, which can boost performance of your web app, as I mentioned. This is the new S2N-Quick, which is an open source Rust implementation of the Quick protocol added to their AWS encryption open source libraries. And as part of this, they are rebranding S2N, which they announced in 2015, to S2N-TLS, making the family now S2N-TLS, S2N-Quick, and S2N-BigNum, as well as the AWS LC round out the S2N family. Several advantages of the S2N-Quick are simple API, highly configurable, extensively tested by AWS, thorough interoperability testing for every code change, verified correctness with post-quantum hybrid key exchange, and maturity for the TLS handshake built within S2 and TLS, and thorough compliance coverage tracking of normative languages and relevant standards. So if you're super nerdy about all things encryption, this is your fun place to go hang out.
Yeah. I just learned, the local zone announcement, and then this, we must be hitting some huge just brick walls in web performance that are just really hurting certain application workloads that require low latency. Because this is, if you look at both these announcements back to back, they're really trying to improve that performance for that last bit. So,
yeah, definitely go hand in hand for sure. I was going to say it's pretty much the same thing, that this would certainly enable like much faster performance of API calls from local zones to the main zones that they're tied to. Mm-hmm. I'm assuming that AWS are building a whole lot of stuff in Rust now versus Java, which they used to.
It would make sense. I mean, I've looked at most of the hiring roles recently. They're all requiring some form of Rust experience or at least some familiarity with the technology. So, from a scaling perspective and overhead of Java versus Rust, I think Rust is a much more scalable, less resource-intensive solution for them. So it makes sense that they would be going down that path.
Yeah, and I mean, and Quick in general, not specifically this Rust library, but Quick in general is, I think, a huge step forwards for performance for the web as a whole, and it's only really enabled by the fact that networks are a lot more reliable than they used to be. Mm-hmm. If Amazon manage their own network, they manage the direct connects, they manage the connections between local zones and the regular zones. They know that they're losing one in a million packets or less, and so they can afford to use a UDP based protocol for this type of exchange, and they shave off potentially 35 milliseconds for every single query that gets made across that line. It's going to be game changing.
And, you know, like, it's not like you can't lose something in using the Quick protocol either. Like, it's just handled at a different layer of the stack.
Yeah. It's like, first, let's try this. And if it doesn't work, then we fall back to the old way where we have the handshakes and obviously it's built, obviously the same error correction and packet handling is built into the implementation of Quick itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I look forward to seeing this end up in load balancers.
Isn't Rust also one of Werner's favorites?
I have no idea. I know the Linux kernel is starting to see more and more code contributed as Rust. I wouldn't be surprised if eventually a lot of that moves over to be Rust instead of C.
This is an easier language to use. It's interesting, as in the article they talk about, you know, the fact that this protocol exists makes it easier for low, you know, availability or slow performing network links in general, which, you know, we also mentioned, you know, the speed of the network is why we're wanting to build these things, but it's also a benefit to the slower network so that this thing is so fast. So it's interesting that it's caused by our need for faster networks, yet it also helps these much slower, less reliable networks be more, you know, better as well. It's kind of interesting catch 22. It's like we optimize for one thing, but we benefited both, which is not very often happens in technology. All right, AWS is announcing the GA release of AWS Backup for S3, which adds Amazon S3 to the set of supported services in your AWS backup. This makes it easier to centrally automate backups and restore of your application data stored in S3, along with other AWS services for compute, storage, and databases. Now, with organizations, you can also centrally create and manage immutable backups of S3 across all of your accounts, protecting your data from inadvertent or malicious actions and restoring the data to your specific point in time with a few simple clicks, which is finally the use case that I actually understand why this exists. Because in my world, AWS backups or go to S3. And so why would I want to back up my backup? But in the world of, you know, ransomware and malware and everything, you know, you need the ability to roll these things back. And so now you get this capability to protect your backups from, you know, malicious actors as well. I think that's a nice use case that I hadn't thought of before when they first announced this thing.
Yeah. I mean, that was my first thought too. It was like, why would I, that just sounds expensive. You know, why would I do that? The resiliency in S3 is fine, right? But yeah, the immutability portion of this makes a lot of sense. And, you know, this feature replaces a lot of automation that a lot of people have built to, you know, ship data into, you know, either, you know, an immutable account or offsite or, you know, however they want to manage that to protect themselves against ransomware. So this is, you know, a great enablement for those teams.
Yeah. And even if you could do this with what you could do with, you know, the current features of versioning and MFA back, you know, required for deletes, the whole concept of point in time management is worth it for me.
Yeah. I mean, being able to, from a compliance perspective, have a centralized view is super valuable as well. Yep. Just like, yes, auditor, go look at my configuration. You can see what's covered and what's not covered, when they were successful or not successful. So, mm-hmm. You know, there's lots of really weird compliance requirements come around backups. So it's nice to have this option for sure.
Then the question is just how thin are they doing it, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Hopefully it's real thin, because, you know, yeah, block pointers would solve most of this need versus, you know, replicating full data between buckets, which is super expensive, which is how people have done it forever. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, this definitely enables a much better use case to not have to do that. Well, if you have heard us talk about AWS budgets on the show before, you know that there's a love-hate of them here. I particularly don't like them for the fact that it doesn't factor in any of my RIs or reserved instance savings plan costs. And so I get an alert every month on the 3rd because the budget basically exceeds. But if you factor in the savings plan, you know, it would be fine. But they don't do that till the end of the month, so the budget doesn't really work. And that's an annoyance. And so Amazon sort of come to my rescue this week with auto-adjusting budgets, which dynamically set your budget based on historical cost or usage over a time range that you specify. This reduces the guesswork in setting a budget limit and keeps you updated as your spending pattern changes. Auto-adjusting budgets are now available in all regions, and you can set budget methods on fixed, planned, or auto-adjusting basis. And if you're looking to catch spikes in cloud spend, using auto-adjusting budgets to receive alerts when your cost or usage pattern changes as a complement to your existing budgets is a great idea. At the beginning of each new period, AWS Budgets calculates your auto-adjusted budget amount using historical billing data within the specified time range and notifies everyone subscribing to the SNS topic of the budget change. You know, initially when I read this, I was like, this is stupid. Like, why do I care about, you know, the fact that, you know, if I spend $100 every month and then all of a sudden it's going to, you know, just set my budget to $100. But this is for people who are looking for that spike, right? Or that weird anomaly where all of a sudden their number went from $100 a month to now it's $6,000 a month and they didn't know about it. Which is, that's not a bad choice, but I don't think it's a, I don't think this is something you use without using also a set budget or a forecasted budget. So I think this is something you add to your budgets, not replace personally, but what do you guys think?
Yeah, it's a usage anomaly detector, which nobody would buy if you said that. And they're probably using the budget tool to do it. That's why the budget product group decided to call it auto adjusting budgets. But I think it's super valuable. Like we have sandbox accounts across, you know, dozens of engineers, most of which are at zero. And it's super helpful when someone spins something up for an hour. That was a pretty pricey workload. They're testing some Terraform for a customer or something, and then they forget to tear it down and you don't find out till the end of the month. Because it's just too difficult to put budgets on across all those accounts. So I think anomaly detection is awesome for spend.
Yeah, I get this, you know, asked this question all the time. Why don't I do more budgets in my day job? And, you know, this is the primary reason why I don't, which is that every workload in separate accounts is unique. And, you know, if you're a centralized provider of, you know, AWS to the rest of your business, then how are you close enough to the business to really understand whether the budget is set appropriately or not? And so this is a good way where we can sort of put that in there, get the notification out there to get the visibility and complete the dev lifecycle, so they see the notification, not just, you know, my angry emails at the, you know, end of the month. And you know, this is fantastic for those where you can catch those anomalies. And also, I think that the notification where it's adjusting still gives you that sort of check of like you've exceeded your budget a little bit.
Yeah, I can see using this for our logging platform, for example, where we know there's going to be growth. And so we'll reach the retention period for the logs in 5 years' time. We know there's going to be periodic growth every month of a certain number of dollars per month for S3 storage or something else. And so it makes sense that the budget increases based on that trend, but can still alert on the fact that all of a sudden, you know, somebody spun up some Bitcoin miners or something in the account, which is a spike that's unexpected.
It'll be my CloudWatch Insights queries as I try to make sense of what the data is, you know.
Yeah, my only complaint about this is I wish it was just called anomaly detection budgets versus auto adjusting. But yeah, naming is not AWS's strong suit by any stretch.
Hey everyone, Jonathan here. I just wanted to take a minute to thank the cloud consulting gurus at Foghorn for helping make the Cloud Pod possible. These folks truly get it. Cloud consulting experts since 2008. They are premier tier partners with AWS, Google Cloud Platform Silver, and Microsoft Azure partners. From multi-cloud to containers to moving full production workloads to the cloud under the tightest compliance, Foghorn's team of full-stack cloud engineers have been there, done that, gotten the t-shirt, and are ready to share their experience with you. If you're in the market for some talent to supplement your team, visit www.fogops.io/thecloudpod. www.fogops.io/thecloudpod. Foghorn, the promise of cloud delivered.
Move to Google. Google is announcing the general availability of Dataplex, an intelligent data fabric that enables you to centrally manage, monitor, and govern data across data lakes, data warehouses, and data marts, and make this data securely accessible to a variety of analytics and data science tools. Dataplex enables companies to delegate ownership, usage, and sharing of data to data owners who have the right business context, while maintaining a single control plane point to consistently monitor and govern across various data domains and their organization. So I checked out a demo of this. It's pretty nice. You know, it gives you kind of that single pane of glass for all your data and all your data warehouses or data ponds or data marts, whatever you're calling them these days. And overall, creating this data mesh view is super helpful.
I mean, this is definitely a hard problem for companies to solve. You know, data is not going to be uniform and you're going to have many different sources of it. And so, you know, and you want it all play nice together so it's usable across, you know, a larger view than it used to be. So I like these types of solutions where they're sort of applying a governance and a way of doing things that's not just, you know, everyone sort of reinventing these wheels, which is what we've been doing up until now.
Especially with the ability to use all sorts of different fine-tuned products. You know, different storage classes, different storage products for different use cases, and then not end up with just silos everywhere.
Yeah, I think it's very important for use cases like healthcare, for example, where patients may have said, you can use my data for this very specific purpose. or for this particular study or something else, but not for anything else. And so having the controls in place to be able to gate who has access to the customer data based on what they've approved and what they haven't is super important.
Well, if you were excited 2 years ago, an OpenSSH 8.2 released and gave you native support for FIDO authentication, you were probably super excited that here now that Google's OS login service for SSH management now supports FIDO keys. So if you've been looking for that ability to send a very cryptic key to all of your Slack messages when you accidentally bump the key, you can now enjoy that use for all your Google needs. So I always appreciate that. Thanks for sharing your key.
I'll never forget the first time I learned, we had a centralized Bastion service in my day job. And the fact that you would load up your SSH keys into an agent and you think you're all slick, and the fact that you could just very easily usurp that key because it's on a centralized server. So I like announcements like this because it does really add a layer of security, especially if you've got more than one user on a node for SSHing to other nodes. So, but it is pretty funny. I don't think I'll ever get used to those security keys just because they do inject strings where you don't want them.
All right. Well, we've talked about Cloud Spanner many, many times here on the show. And, we sort of joke about it. It's this massive lock-in. It's all kinds of things. Google's here today to tell us about Cloud Spanner myths and busting those myths. And so I wanted to share them with you all and see what you guys think of these myths. And so the first one up for Spanner, and of course, Spanner is their globally available database product. Only use Spanner if you have a massive workload is the first myth. And the truth is that Spanner powers Google's most popular globally available products like YouTube, Drive, and Gmail. And so, of course, the default assumption is that you need massive scalability to make this work for you. And Google's here to tell you, regardless of the workload size, every customer on the journey to cloud wants the benefits of scalability and availability while reducing the operational burden and the costs associated with patching, upgrades, and other maintenance. So what do you guys think about the myth of massive workloads are required for Spanner to be effective?
I would agree that that is a myth.
Yep.
I've yet to use it. I'm excited for my first project.
Yeah, I've never priced out a sizable enough workload on Spanner to really know if it's, because I've always seen it as it makes sense that it's a little bit more expensive because it's more feature rich. And so if I have the need for that global redundancy, great. But if it's more expensive and I don't really need it, it's just a nice to have, and, maybe it's not the suitable one. But I think that, like all things, that sort of initial analysis turns into rumor and speculation and just becomes sort of tribal knowledge.
Second myth is Spanner is too expensive. And so Google here tells you you're looking at the wrong metric. So you should be looking at total cost of ownership versus raw list pricing. And they believe they deliver you significant value to your customer starting at the price, including critical things like availability, price performance, and reduced operational costs, as well as increased security and compliance, as they allege they have way more than you do. And best of all, they provide you both granular instance sizing as well as an autoscaler to help you right-size your Spanner instances and take advantage of the TTLs available to reduce your data stored. So that's the second myth. This one I have heard many times, that Spanner is expensive. And I think this is true of many cloud technologies where people look at just the list price and say, wow, that's really expensive. Look how expensive RDS databases are, or there are things. And it's, you really do have to look at it from a total cost of ownership perspective. And I agree with that opinion. And again, your experience may vary, but don't just count it out because the list price is expensive. Look at what it's going to take you to manage that PostgreSQL database.
But on the other hand, if people are complaining that they feel it's too expensive for the value they're getting, either it's too expensive or they're using the wrong tool for the job. So which one of those is it? Is it a sales problem? Are they advertising this for people who don't need this level of service, or is it actually too expensive?
I mean, how many times have you had a conversation with a product manager who doesn't understand what the basic, uptime requirements of their product are? And so they just, say, well, we need a tier A, tier one app that needs all the things and all the bells and whistles. And you go build out this massively globally replicated application and kind of find out when it's down, the customers don't complain. And so you don't really need that level of redundancy. That happens all the time. So I think, yes, Google could do a much better job identifying use cases and things that could be addressed to help make that decision better. But, I think it's a combination of many factors.
Lots of stakeholders involved, right? You can build an app and you can build in high availability and think you're good. And then all of a sudden you find that, you know, your risk team says that this needs to be compliant to some, you know, alphabet soup regulation. And then all of a sudden you do have to start rolling this out across multiple regions and have replication and prove that, you know, the replication works within the objective, all those things. And so I think it's one of those things where it gets really difficult. It depends on when you're pricing this out. Like, are you looking for a new workload? Or are you looking to, you know, make an existing workload more resilient? I think you'd probably come up with different numbers and different priorities if you were doing that. That's tricky.
Yeah, I guess it depends. Who's saying it's too expensive? Is it the development team because they think they don't need to spend that much money? They think, oh, that's a lot of money for this. Oh, we need a database. Or is it the compliance team who's saying this is expensive? We need this level of service, but it's too expensive. Mm-hmm. Or you know, who is it that's making these complaints? Where do this come from? That's what I'd like to know. Because compliance is expensive.
It is expensive.
Exactly. Performance is expensive. Availability is expensive. Yeah. What type of, if you're looking for run a science project in a sandbox, maybe it's too expensive. That.
Yeah, I mean, it's easy for a developer to say, but I run this on my local machine with my local Postgres and it only costs this much. I only need one core and this many gig of RAM. In production, it doesn't work the same way. And in the real world, it doesn't work the same way. Yeah.
All right. Next one, I think, is based really on the white papers that birthed Spanner. So there's a lot of talk in the original white papers about ACID compliance and data replication. And so there's this myth that you have to make a trade-off between scale, consistency, and latency. And Google wants you to know the truth is, depending on the use case and instance configuration, users can use Spanner such that they don't have to pick between consistency, latency, and scale. To provide that strong data consistency, they use a synchronous Paxos-based replication scheme in which replications acknowledge every write request, and a write is committed when a majority of the replicas, 2 out of 3, called a quorum. Also, reads can be served by strong by default or stale. A strong read is a read at a current timestamp and is guaranteed to see all the data that's been committed up until the start of the read. Or a stale read is a read executed at a timestamp in the past. And so you have many different options. And again, I think this is an architectural challenge of you just need to think about how your database and application work. And as you go global, you have to make some of these decisions. And, you know, real-time data or stale data is a good question to be asking. But a lot of companies and a lot of dev teams don't even think about. And again, the write latency and write needs are very important for multi-region architecture. And you probably do want to guarantee that write made it to multiple regions if you want global consistency and global scale. So again, these are problems that you would have on any database technology. They're not just Google. I think these are hypersensitive to these because they were called out pretty heavily in the white paper initially when it came out with Cloud Spanner.
Yeah, and I would agree that although this myth is not busted, it has nothing really to do with something that Spanner is doing wrong or something that's missing from Spanner. It has to do mostly with the speed of light.
Yeah, it's a weird comparison to make between those three because of the three of them, scale is one which never enters into the CAP theorem, consistency, availability, and what's the third one? PPP, partition tolerance. There we go. but scale is a problem for the service itself. You know, can the service manage my 1 gig of data or 1 terabyte of data or 1 petabyte of data? That's not on me. That's on Google at this point. So if they're already claiming that I can use small workloads or big workloads, they've already got that covered. That's fine. So are we still making trade-offs between those other things? Who knows? I'd say this is semi-busted. This is a marketing thing, not a fair comparison between three things, which are all interrelated.
I guess the only piece scale comes into question of that is when you start talking about multiple geographic locations scale, mm-hmm. which sure I can have. I don't have to make any trade-offs if all these things are sitting in the same rack. I'm going to have great, but
that's
if
fair.
If I got to go global and I can't guarantee that each and every user is going to be very close to a majority of my nodes to get a quorum, then no, I have to wait for the write to, you know, get confirmed in a different location. So.
No, yes, that's fair. I mean, that is the partition tolerance part of Paxos. Yeah. And So I'd say, I mean, I think that kind of lends to my argument in that ultimately you will reach a scale where there is too much data to replicate in the time available, or replicating to too many nodes in the time available to actually make all those three things achievable at the same time. So I call BS on this one.
Not busted. Myth not busted.
Myth not busters.
Myth number four is Spanner does not have a familiar interface. And you know, they then point out that we added a Postgres interface, which is still in pre-GA. They just announced like 4 months ago. So yes, this clearly was a real complaint and a real myth. And now you've tried to solve it by giving us a Postgres interface for this. So I appreciate that. It does support SQL dialect based on the ANSI 2011 standard, as well as via REST or gRPC. But most database developers don't talk REST or gRPC. They talk SQL. So making a Postgres interface is a good call. I think this myth it will be busted when this is finally generally available, but it's a little weak sauce to cause that one myth busted at this exact moment.
To be fair, like, well, I agree the myth isn't busted, but I also hate that, you know, the outcry on these things. Like, it doesn't talk SQL. It talks this other thing. Like, every other area besides databases, we've changed the way we interact with computers over time, with the exception of databases. And I think while I understand the reasoning for some of those things, none of it's like performance or the ability to get service. It's just the syntax in which you're running the queries and doing that. And I don't know if it really makes a lot of sense that, you know, it has to speak this one language or we can't use it.
Yeah, I think whether the service itself supports SQL natively is the question. Whether you can translate the SQL queries, structured query language, it's something which makes it easy for people to construct queries on massive data sets with linked tables. It's a good language. You can see it's a good language because every popular database has gone back and reintroduced SQL support when they start off as NoSQL. So it's yep. It's something that people use. It's something that people can get their heads around. It enables developers to get their jobs done. I mean, whether Spanner supports it natively or not should be an arbitrary thing if that translation can be done in an SDK or somewhere else.
Yeah, when even NoSQL speaks SQL, that's when...
Yeah, exactly.
Come on, man. That's the bar of entry if you're going to have a relational database.
I don't know if it's a barrier entry. I mean, I get why you would go back and you would add... SQL support into your NoSQL. That makes total sense to me. You're just trying to increase your user base. But you know, the people that are refusing to use the technology because it doesn't have the SQL, that I think is a completely different argument. You know, adapt, you know, make changes, learn a new thing. I don't think you need to be as tied to a specific query language. But you know, yeah, if it's available and you already have the investment, go for it.
Maybe as an individual developer, that applies. But if you're thinking about, well, we've got a $10 million SQL Server, you know, Microsoft SQL Server bill or an Oracle bill coming up, we'd really like to get this migrated off this platform onto something else, which is more cloud-friendly, more distributed. Having a common language in which you can speak to the new technology versus the old technology makes those migrations far easier.
No, for sure.
Would you call it familiar?
So the next one I'm calling is just, this is a marketing article and I want to have a myth that talks about how amazing we are with OpenTelemetry, because I've never heard anyone mention observability of their database that was serious about it, unless they were a database administrator. So myth number five is the only way to get observability data is via the Spanner console. So I mean, if you guys want to make fun of that just like I did, you're more than welcome to, but ultimately this data is available to you via OpenTelemetry. You can get it into other things. This is a marketing item, in my opinion, that, hey, we did all this OpenTelemetry thing, but no one cares because no one actually thinks it's a myth that they worry about.
So what you're saying is the myth is busted. However, the myth was never created.
Yeah. It never existed.
Really, it was only created by, yeah. Myth was created by marketing and then busted.
Perfect.
Yeah. Yeah. AppDynamics or somebody else was like, hey, you know.
Myth number six, Spanner is only for global workloads requiring copies in multiple regions. And Google wants you to know that the truth is that while Spanner offers a range of multi-region instance configurations, it also offers regional configuration in each GCP region. Each regional node is replicated in three zones within the region, while a multi-regional node is replicated at least 5 times across multiple regions. Typically, multi-regional instances configurations are indicated if your application runs workloads in multiple geographic locations or your business needs 5 nines of availability and protection against regional failures. This is sort of a weird one to me. I don't know that I've had this myth either, but maybe someone did because they thought it was global scale and my problem isn't global.
Yeah, I've definitely heard this actually. People confusing the ability to scale globally with, oh, if I'm not global, that's not a product for me.
I almost see this as the same as myth number two, that it's expensive, right? So, because that's usually how these come up, is that you think that you have to deploy your workloads globally in multiple regions. And so it gets really expensive. I've never quite understood that sort of, use case where you would need it within a single region. And so therefore you think you'd have to deploy it to multiple regions. It just doesn't make sense to me, but I have heard it.
But how much more expensive to go back and re-engineer something as fundamental as your data store for an application? If you say launch a product in North America and then you move to Europe or Asia or someplace, Australia or somewhere else, much easier to start and swallow that cost now instead of having to go and re-engineer and redeploy all your technology later on in order to support a global deployment in the future. So, yeah.
Especially if you picked a platform that doesn't support SQL.
Myth number seven, Spanner schema changes require expensive locks. I have heard this one. This one is true. and I think this is just initial issues. There was a myth that they had table level locks, but that's not really the case. Spanner uses a multi-version concurrency control architecture to manage concurrent versions of a schema and data, allowing ad hoc and online qualified schema changes that do not require any downtime, additional tools, migration pipelines, or complex rollback backup plans. And when issuing a schema update, you can continue writing and reading from database without interruption while Spanner backfills the update. So I think this one comes from, there's a couple of really aggressive blog posts about Spanner scaling and the write backfill in particular. And so I think, this one is born by the internet, but is definitely a myth I've seen out there.
Yeah, that's fair. I agree with you. I'd like to see an application which can deal itself with multiple schemas, because oftentimes we have to stop the application because there are now two schemas in play and we have to update the database because this new version requires the old schema or the new schema, sorry. Mm-hmm. And so, being able to support sort of dynamic updates of rows to the new schema versions as they're updated or as they're queried is actually really cool.
Took the words right out of my mouth.
Yep. Yeah.
So that's it. Mythbusters job is done here. The Google marketing team has succeeded in busting all the myths, right?
It's still expensive.
The Cloud Pile will continue to spread these myths because we have no shame. Yeah. Yeah. Again, some of them are marketing created myths, but the other ones are good ones. So. But Cloud Spanner has a PostgreSQL interface, so it's really grown up. It's a true boy now.
Yeah, I really see this, the need to have an article like this as just a failure of marketing for the product in the first place.
Honestly, I was thinking that as you were talking about marketing things up. I would agree. I think Cloud Spanner had a really big splash initially, and people were really excited about it, and then we've heard really nothing about it since it kind of, part of that's because, Google Cloud Digital Next has not been happening in person and the keynotes have been pretty lackluster. But you would think that, if this is supposed to be the big answer to Aurora, which is basically their version of Aurora, especially with adding PostgreSQL to it, I would think that they would be announcing this more in a big way and with big splash and more attention. And maybe they are to their customer base, behind the scenes and QBRs and to existing customers. But new customers are excited about this kind of stuff too. And if you're trying to win hearts and minds away from AWS or Azure, you got to be vocal about this stuff.
Agreed.
Well, if you are an Azure customer, the Azure Spring Cloud Enterprise is now available to you in preview. This is if you were unhappy with the enterprise-ness of the normal version. And so Azure Spring Cloud Enterprise includes commercially supported Spring runtime components to help enterprises enterprise customers shape faster and unlock Spring's full potential. Available in preview for all customers. This is an expansion of the Azure and VMware capabilities and now brings Tanzu portfolio products into the mix. The benefits of the new enterprise offering include leveraging Tanzu build services and cloud-native build packs to make it easier to build and deploy Spring, Java, Node.js, Python, Go, and .NET Core applications, and configure the associated APM agents. You can effortlessly route client request applications via the Tanzu Spring Cloud Gateway, and you can leverage the Tanzu API portal, app config services, and service registry as well, and get long-term support for all of this 24/7. So if you wanted, you know, not enterprise enough, you now have enterprise, and someday soon, I'm sure you'll have ultra premium enterprise for those who just want to burn money sometime in the future.
I think this is a very interesting play into Tanzu from VMware because, you know, it's Spring is, you know, a Java framework as part of the underlying application that you can leverage. And, you know, a lot of these enhancements aren't really, you know, like at the application level. Like, and so it's, you know, being able, I guess, to have uniformity across building and deploying these things and leverage other technologies is, I mean, it's obviously good, but it is strange to see it sort of handled this way from like an Amazon or an Azure service. I'm still just really not sure.
You lost me at Spring.
He lost me at if I'm an Azure customer.
It's interesting because I was reading this announcement and they talk about Tanzu multiple times. You know, never anywhere did they mention Kubernetes in associated with Tanzu. It's just like VMware is like, we'll never mention this as Kubernetes. It's just Tanzu. It's like, is that? I don't know if that's hurting or helping them though. It's like, you know, I almost feel like they get more respect if they called it Tanzu for Kubernetes, or you know, or is separating themselves from Kubernetes making them in a better situation for people who hate Kubernetes. Like, I'm not sure which way it's going.
It's probably good for SEO, and that's about it.
I mean, I wonder if it is that, or if it's, you know, the VMware sort of diehards are anti Kubernetes because they see it as a competitor. I don't think that's true, but maybe there's something to it because it is strange. I just realized that this is just hosting your application like Cloud Run or you know, light sale or anything else. Like this isn't anything other than we will host your app for you. This is being sold all a weird way to me. I don't know. Maybe I just didn't understand it.
You know, it's not my market, so yeah.
I'm not gonna comment.
Yeah. But you know, it definitely seems like almost a pass play, right? Like we're building an answer to Elastic Beanstalk, but yeah, with VMware in the mix. It is sort of weird.
But they're never really saying that, but that's exactly what it is. Like when you go through, like it doesn't say that in the press release, but when I look at the screenshot in the article, that's what it is. You're through their console, you're selecting your name and your region, your redundancy, your resources. And then I assume you just upload a jar file somewhere. And so this really is just platform as a service. Just being sold as this weird integration that I don't understand.
Which is not a bad thing. PaaS is great, but yeah. Call it what it is.
But speaking of bad marketing, like, like yeah, what is this? I don't know. Spring Enterprise. What?
Well, I mean, if you're really into the Java Spring framework, you'd probably be excited about this. But yeah, if you never did Java development in Spring, then you're like, I don't know what this is. So yeah, it does sort of actually limit their market a little bit too, because it does more than Spring. It does normal Java. It does Node.js. Yeah. It does Python. It does Go. Yeah. So lumping it into the Spring thing is kind of a bad call. But you know, whatever.
Yeah.
When does Microsoft just buy VMware? I mean, if they're gonna get this embedded on their cloud, just buy them.
Yeah.
Well, Azure is finally here with support for mutual authentication in the Azure Application Gateway. You can upload multiple client certificate authority chains on the app gateway to use for client authentication, and you can choose to enable front-end mutual auth at a per-listener level. And you can also pass specific cert information to the back-end as HTTP headers. So congratulations, Azure. You're now finally caught up to both Google and AWS on mutual auth. Congratulations. Yep.
That said, for those people having to support mutual auth in those environments, this is a godsend. Because it is not an easy challenge to manage all these things. And so happy to see a centralized service where it at least makes it a little simpler.
It is good they've had it. I'm actually surprised that they were the last, as far as I know, the last of the big three to add this kind of support. Because if you think about it, Active Directory has enabled this kind of authentication for 25 years now.
Just not at the app layer.
Just not at the app layer. Yeah, I mean, the directory has been able to verify the identity of people and servers for such a long time, and to see it take this long to get this into the app layer is crazy. Mm-hmm. So they were actually ahead of the game at one point.
They were, and then they, as Azure likes to do, they just miffed it. So there you go. All right, Peter, you're back. Take us the lightning round.
Amazon Redshift announces support for unloading data to JSON files.
Oof. It's one way to reduce my Redshift costs. I'm just going to unload everything.
Yeah.
The only thing I want to unload to JSON files is my shotgun.
All I've learned is all data could just be JSON files. JSON everywhere. JSON. That and YAML.
YAML for the win.
Announcing Amazon QuickSight's new community hub.
So I can loudly proclaim I don't know how to do this to a larger community. Thank you, QuickSight.
Unfortunately, I went to the QuickSight community, and you know those westerns where the tumbleweeds just go across the road? It felt sort of like that, empty and desolate.
Needs me some spaghetti westerns. Mm-hmm. All right. Amazon RDS for MariaDB now supports delayed replication.
Peter, it's a PG show. Oh, sorry. Replication.
I don't know. When I replicate my data, it's always delayed.
Oh, I'm so disappointed. That's all we got out of that. AWS Transfer Family now supports login banners.
Yeah, and the banner says, welcome to 1995.
With that flashing HTML font.
The rainbow text.
Yeah.
Yes.
Nice. I'll go to King's Landing, but not alone. Call the banners.
Oh, God. That's pretty good. Announcing Amazon Redshift cross-region data sharing.
I can't share it with other accounts. I might as well share it cross-region. Sure. Thanks.
But now I can unload it all into JSON and just move it over there.
All right, I'll just share it with S3 replication. That's right. Why do I need Redshift? Mm-hmm. It saves so much money.
Amazon CloudWatch Container Insights. Add support for Amazon EKS Fargate using AWS Distro for OpenTelemetry.
Bingo!
Seriously.
Yeah. That's a lot of words to say you're adopting OpenTelemetry. Like, a lot of words.
Hey, that's a diagonal from left to right. I got it. It's all mine.
That was blackout. I felt like I went blackout on that one.
Yeah.
Announcing automatic workload management for Amazon Redshift concurrency scaling.
I mean, when I scale for JSON, does it scale up or down? That works out going to outload the data. So it's going to scale it down, right?
Scale it down. Yeah.
It's perfect. So I can do the JSON thing to S3, and then I can just turn off the Redshift cluster. I mean, it's a pathway to Snowflake if I ever saw one.
Mm-hmm. It is. But, you know, if you leave the Redshift cluster on, you're still paying for it, even if you're not using it. It's true.
Yeah.
All right. Short and sweet, unless Jonathan has something interesting and exciting for
him. Not really. I was going to say,
if
a Redshift cluster falls in the forest and there's nobody there, does it still cost money? Yes. Yes, it does.
It does. It definitely still costs money. Yep. All right. Banners and bingo. Justin.
Yeah.
Nice.
Boom.
Yeah.
I've been holding on. I mean, you've gone for weeks. Like, I just, you know, I felt like I needed to deliver this today. So.
You did a good job. All right.
Well, thank you. There are things coming up that you may want to go to, I think, except for you probably don't want to go to IBM Think. That is May 9th through 13th. But, you know, your CIO friend who doesn't get fired for buying IBM will definitely be there at IBM Think. But before that is the SQL Server and Azure SQL Conference, April 5th through the 7th. And if you're like, yeah, I don't want that SQL stuff. I want big data and I want AI and I want ML. Google Cloud Summit Series has launched their updating regularly blog post, which they never update regularly, by the way. with the first one being the Data Cloud Summit, April 6th, which is all of your AI, ML, analytics, databases, and more. You can go yell at your salespeople about that Cloud Spanner myth that we didn't talk about and go have those conversations, hopefully, at the Data Cloud Summit. I believe this is going to be online only. So again, this will be online virtual yelling at your computer screen, which is the best kind of yelling because no one gets offended. So, and that is all the good things coming up quickly here in the cloud. And have another great week. See you soon.
Yeah.
Good night. Bye, everybody.
And that is the Week in Cloud. We'd like to thank our sponsor, Foghorn Consulting. Subscribe on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts and tweet us your feedback at #TheCloudPod. Or join our Slack channel, go to our website, thecloudpod.net, for sign-up instructions.